Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Through thick and thin, through great glories and great mistakes, Americans have turned back again and again for a long time now to the story of the Pilgrims of Plymouth Colony for origin story, for inspiration, for table decorations at Thanksgiving. A new documentary looks deeply at the true, full story of the Pilgrims, at the inspiring and the radical that took them to some truly harrowing places, at their vision of a new, pure life. This hour On Point, the deep story of the Pilgrims. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you want to know the details, the whole story? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from a descendant of the Native Americans the Pilgrims encountered at Plymouth and a top Pilgrim scholar. Joining me first here in the studio is filmmaker and writer Rick Burns. His new documentary is The Pilgrims. It will air on PBS on November 24th at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, and again on Thanksgiving Day. You can go to our website to see the trailer. Rick Burns, it is great to have you right here.
Thank you, Tom. I'm so pleased to be here.
You Burns boys, you and Ken really know how to make a documentary. This is a beautiful documentary
on the Pilgrims.
And I came in, you know, you can't help but come in a little skeptical, like we know the Pilgrims, we know so much, they can seem cliched and all the rest. And you tell a really remarkable story in quite a beautiful way here. I think people will be enlightened and maybe at some points disturbed sitting down to watch this on Thanksgiving Day, but ultimately learn a lot about this country's history and this origin story that is so central. What got your attention to come back and look at this one again? We think we know it so well.
We do think we know it so well. It kind of stands for history and the origins of our history in the American mind. And it's not as if there's not a lot of truth to that. But we forget almost everything actual about the Pilgrims when we sit down to eat turkey on Thanksgiving. It's a kind of almost collective form of amnesia. The little story that we remember is airbrushed around the edges. Some of it's true, most of it's not, and we leave out 99% of the story. It's so harrowing. It's so moving. It's so strange. The religious component of it is so telling and so kind of breathtaking. Why they came? Why did these people come? You know, I was approached about 4 years ago by Jeff Bieber from WETA in Washington and said, hey, I've just read this incredible new book called Making Haste from Babylon by an Englishman named Nick Bunker. I went to college with Nick Bunker, so I said, I got to do this film. But the essential takeaway from Nick's book is, you know, we think of ourselves, we know, well, right, the Pilgrims, they were English, but they were really instant Americans. Why? Because, well, we think of them as coming for God, coming for freedom, being gentle and loving the Native Americans. They don't have slaves. So they're kind of – we've created an image of them that's quite, you know, quite a bit at odds with the truth and which we like to think of them. They came – though they were English, they were already Americans. So in other words, we disconnect ourselves from the history we pretend to remember. Who were they? Who were these radical Protestant English? They were zealots. They were cultists. You could not be more radical within the Protestant faith than the Pilgrims. And they had to get right with God, and that means they had to separate from the Church of England, which had too many holdovers from Catholicism. And that was against the law. Why? Because church and state in Elizabeth and James's England are connected. So if you separate from church, you're separating from state.
You're challenging
the authority of the crown. And if you look at English history in the late 16th, early 17th century, there's a lot that's up for grabs. And the establishment, church and state, don't want that kind of trouble. People can lose their heads for that, you know. So it was against the law. They were going to go to jail. And they decided that they were convinced that if they didn't come out and be separate from the corruption, the satanic corruption of the church in England, they're going to go to hell.
It was a political stance. It was also a profoundly religious, spiritual pilgrimage.
Absolutely.
To create what? Something like heaven on earth or find the way to heaven.
To go back to what they imagined to be apostolic Christianity the way Christ and the disciples had it.
The New Jerusalem.
The New Jerusalem, which would have no popes, no bishops, no mitres, no incense, no rituals, no mass, no Eucharist. That's all add-ons. That's corruption. It's where two or three of you are gathered together in my name, Christ says to his disciples in Matthew. There we are. So it's just the body of believers apart from all the fallen hoo-ha, and that's where the church will be.
They would make and find that in the new world. They didn't have much choice. It basically chased out of England or ran away, then and out of the Netherlands and onward. Here's Pauline Croft, historian at Royal Holloway, University of London, in Rick Burns' new documentary, The Pilgrims.
The fact that they are, in the long term, extraordinarily successful, that they've found the world's greatest democracy, throws retrospective luster. They are, one might say, if you wanted to be critical, they're religious nutters who won't settle for anything except the most literal reading of the Bible. They want to transform a nation state into something that resembles what they take to be a godly kingdom.
A godly kingdom, religious nutters. And when they reach the shores of North America after an absolutely harrowing voyage, half or more of the people on the boat didn't end up being pilgrims. They were what William Bradford called the strangers. The
profane.
Not religious, but added on. I didn't know that this group that financed them was called the Merchant Adventurers?
The Fellowship of the Merchant Adventurers. It sounds a little bit like a corrupt hedge fund on Wall Street matched with the Lord of the Rings.
Yes, it does.
It's incredible. And that's sort of not what they were. Their main guy, Thomas Weston, was a sharp practicing charlatan who kind of foreclosed on every promise he made. So these kind of naive religious zealots were being taken advantage of from the beginning. They began to make their plans from their exile in Holland in 1617, 1618.
It was all too late in the season. They should have sailed in the spring or very early summer. They sailed in September, didn't arrive until winter was almost on them. Here's Bernard Balin, Harvard historian, talking about what they faced coming ashore that first winter.
Everything was wrong. I mean, they had to reach the shore by wading through ice-cold water to the shoreline. And Bradford says, at one point, with sleet beating at them, they were covered with this ice glaze, and they caught cold and they died.
Simple as that, and many did. William Bradford, at the heart of this story, introduce us to him.
You know, William Bradford is the most moving character in American history I've met in a long time. He was a 12-year-old orphan boy from Yorkshire who'd lost everybody in his life that was close to him, had a huge psychological crisis and a spiritual one. And he found a new kind of family 3 miles away from where he lived in Yorkshire, in the living room of William Brewster, the kind of the elder of this separatist group in early part 1602. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's the emblematic pilgrim. He's the perfect disciple. He joins the group and stays with it for the rest of his life. He follows them out of the church, out of England, out of Holland, and over to America, where after that first horrific winter, mm-hmm. where half of them died. They have less than half of them are alive after their first 3 months. Five families gone, wiped out. Every family's got, you know, orphaned children and a father who's dead or a mother who's dead or both who are dead. Single men coming alone and dying alone. It was a Holocaust amongst that group. That Bradford, you know, became governor in April of 1621, when Governor Carver, the first governor, keeled over in his corn patch, mm-hmm. very much because of the tribulations of that first whole World War. He's the governor then for the next, you know, most decades. Of the next 37 years.
And of course, the best history we have of it comes down to us through the book that he left, Extraordinary Story in Itself. You've got actor Roger Rees in the documentary portraying William Bradford. And here he is reading a passage of what Bradford wrote about that time, coming ashore from the Mayflower, the Pilgrims.
They now had no friends to welcome them, or inns to repair to, or to refresh their weather-beaten bodies. No houses, much less towns to repair to. And it was winter. And they that know the winters of that country know them to be sharp and harsh. Besides, what could they see but a hideous, desolate wilderness full of wild beasts and wild men?
Roger Rees portraying there William Bradford Long, the governor of the Pilgrims, settled in Plymouth. Rick Burns' terrific new documentary comes out next week as we head into Thanksgiving. It's called The Pilgrims. He's with me in the studio. Also with us right now from San Francisco, stand by, Rick. Kathleen Donegan is with us, professor of early American literature at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Seasons of Misery, Catastrophe and Colonial Settlement in Early America, a very compelling voice in this documentary. Kathleen Donegan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Plymouth Colony was not the first colony. Jamestown was. Why are the Pilgrims at the heart of what we now popularly understand as our origin story, Kathleen?
Well, I think it's due in large part to Bradford himself and to his history of Plymouth Plantation. He wrote the history, he imagined their history and gave us their history in that document in a way that we could connect to the story of a humble people, a suffering people, an idealistic people who sacrificed for the idea of some future glory. And nothing of the sort is available to us in the Jamestown archive. Jamestown really shows the colonial experience as it was, you know, brutal and violent and chaotic and confusing, fractious. And it's a very hard story to look at and a hard story to hold on to. Plymouth is much different from that. It's a story that we can elaborate some positive vision of how America began and what our intentions were.
In spite of the fact that William Bradford felt, I guess, at the end, that he did not succeed in creating his new Jerusalem.
Right. Well, because of Bradford's religious commitments and ideological commitments, there was a real separation between earthly success, right, the success of the mission, and the success of staying true to one's faith, staying true to one's community, and to a vision. So, you know, you didn't have people coming to kind of make what they could in the New World and turn around and go back to England. There was no England for them to go back to. There was no place for them to go. So their investment didn't have to do with a quick turnover. Their investment had to do with creating history.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the week before Thanksgiving, we're talking about the true, deep story of the Pilgrims. Harrowing, maybe darker than you knew, and inspiring. A new PBS documentary, The Pilgrims, airs next week. Rick Burns has made it. He's with me in the studio today. Kathleen Donegan of UC Berkeley is with us. She and her scholarship are very much at the heart of it. It's a pretty terrific documentary. You think you know the story? There's much you probably do not. And the spirit of what happened there and unfolded, and sometimes the horror, very effectively portrayed. You can join us this hour. How do you understand the Pilgrims, what they were up to? Do you know just how bad it got at Plymouth Colony before things turned around? And can you imagine the suffering, the hard choices, the faith it took to keep on? And do these images that we'll hear about today, dead and dying pilgrims propped up with their guns in the woods, the Indian head on a pike, square with your image of the Pilgrims? Rick Burns, the plague that had hit this coast in the years before the Pilgrims' arrival is essential to this story. What, it came from European fishermen, came down from Maine, and what scene did they greeted them in terms of human inhabitation and the death toll that had just been suffered by Native Americans as they arrived?
You know, there were tens of thousands. There were so many people in what we now call New England at the time. And when this virgin soil epidemic hit in 1616 and kind of sort of flashed across 3 years.
Virgin soil epidemic. Who called it that? That's,
you know, it's a
politically
soil,
loaded phrase as if
it is
virgin,
you know,
just waiting for somebody, anybody. But there were lots of people who had and did live here.
Absolutely. And with the virgin soil really, in a sense, refers to the epidemiological aspect of it, to a group of people who didn't have an immune system capable of taking these plagues, which, of course, had decimated Europe, you know, in the centuries before. But then we'd built up immunological barriers to it. They didn't have that. And when it hit, it could take out 40, 50, 60, 70% of a population in this kind of path, maybe 20, 25, we're not quite sure, miles inland. When it hit places like Patuxent on the Massachusetts coast, where Plymouth, Patuxent is Plymouth, 2,000 Wampanoags, we think, something like that, lived there, gone, 100% mortality. So they were just wiped out. Of all the accidents of history that our pilgrims, that the Mayflower should have decided to, like, put in there, start a colony there. Well, it was a perfect place. There were no Native Americans right there. They were at the ground zero of this epidemic. So they came to a place of mass death in which the Wampanoags had been absolutely obliterated there, and the fragile Wampanoag remnants 40 miles to the east, more or less around Taunton, Middleboro, were, you know, kind of waiting and watching to see what was going to happen. So they couldn't have come to a better place in that there were very few competitors right there at ground zero for them. But we don't remember that they arrived at a place of mass death any more than we remember that first winter basically was visiting upon them a kind of a prospect of annihilation, very much like what the Wampanoags had faced.
We'll hear in a moment from Linda Combs, descended from those Wampanoags, and hear about the interaction with the Native Americans, absolutely critical, and in a way that I had not honestly fully understood. But that winter, so bitter. Here again is the actor Roger Reese in the documentary The Pilgrims. This is from Bradford's book, reading a passage from his history describing conditions, just how bad things got.
It pleased God to visit us then with death daily, and with so general a disease that the living were scarce able to bury the dead, and the well in no measure sufficient to tend the sick.
The well in no measure sufficient to tend the sick, and some kind of shocking detail that I had never known about bodies, sick and dying, being propped up in the woods with their muskets in their hands to look like sentries when they were dying or corpses.
You know, let's turn it over to Kathleen Donegan, because she's thanks to Kathleen, you know, Kathleen said so beautifully, and she was our guide, our kind of Virgil mm-hmm. to this story. You know, the things we remember and the things we forget about history are usually side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, well, Kathleen, talk a little bit about that. It's an incredible moment when Phineas Pratt comes in and leaves an account, which you made such an extraordinary
Kathleen
part
Donegan?
Of
it.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bradford's history is so powerful. And, you know, when you hear his words come to life, you just see how captivating they are. But as I was researching it, I thought to myself, who else is telling this story, right? What's a different voice that we can get a different angle on this? And I knew that in court records, in New England court records, which are copious, often people told long narratives. And so I went back looking at the court records of distribution of land to what were called the first comers, the first people who got to Plymouth. And there was a man, Phineas Pratt, who was granted land even though he wasn't a first comer because he performed an important service to the colony. And in the court, they asked him, what do you remember? What do you remember about your arrival? And Phineas Pratt tells this story of coming off the ship, expecting to see the pilgrim group there, and seeing only half the people and those he saw just wasted with sickness and disease, and asking, where are all the people? And they tell them the story that sickness has taken them, that so many have died. But they also tell them that during this crisis, they brought their sick people up into the woods and leaned them up. These sick people leaned their backs up against the trees and propped their muskets by their side in order that any Indians looking in through the woods at what's going on in the settlement would see them as a kind of sentinel, would see them as a kind of armed guard in the forest. When these people were actually performing this final sacrifice for their community, dying in the woods as this kind of ghostly sentinel in the forest. And that's a story Bradford does not tell. That's a story that went deep, deep into the archive because it is so profane. And in Bradford and the Pilgrims' point of view, just typologically, I mean, what God would waste their carcasses in the wilderness? This is a biblical curse that is handed down when God takes the promised land away. He says, your carcasses will rot and fall in this wilderness. And that's exactly what happened. So that story went deep, deep in the court records. And so, but through doing this research, I found this Phineas Pratt story, and it gave a whole different view of what daily life looked like in Plymouth Colony.
The depth of darkness and despair that enveloped this is not a typical part of this sort of nice pilgrim collar, big hat with a buckle and the cornucopia that we pull out at Thanksgiving.
You know, for me, some of the best American history that's been done, including Kathleen Donegan's, basically says, when you get to these moments where you get horrific statistics like 750,000 people died in the Civil War or half of them died that first winter, you know, off the Mayflower, go slow. Kathleen's sort of admonition to all of us is go slow when you hit those really horrible stuff, because the natural human tendency is to turn away, move on, go, and how did they persevere? And if you do it too quickly, you miss the impact and miss the impact of how transformed they were by the suffering and, as Kathleen also points out, the violence that they discovered that they were, in a sense, initiated into by their own suffering. And so our following Kathleen's lead and the lead of a number of other scholars, our intent was to try to, like, put it on slow motion a little bit, let it really open up, see it for what it was before you decide you understand what it means, because if you don't, you're going to miss what it really means at a deep level.
And then we come to their interaction with Native Americans, which was so profound. There's a pretty dark view of that that's voiced in the documentary The Pilgrims by anthropologist Margaret Bruschak, describing how they viewed Native Americans. There were some warm, even intimate interactions, but there was a bigger view here, which she raises some huge questions on. They established their settlement literally on the bones of Wampanoag villagers in Patuxet, called Plymouth.
They did not view Native people as humans. They saw them almost as beasts and vermin who were cleared away by God's pestilence to make room for God's chosen people. And so I think it's necessary to ask who the savages were. Were they the people who had lived in this territory for millennia, or were they these people who forced themselves into someone else's home?
Margaret Bruschak, anthropologist there, with kind of the toughest interpretation of the Pilgrims. There are warmer interpretations here. Kathleen, is it as clear as that to you? Beasts and vermin? I mean, they also made real human contact, not least with Tusquantum, whose story we know, the young Indian who had been taken away in chains to Europe and returned to his village, Patuxet. Mm-hmm. It was essentially gone. He befriended and saved them. It was kind of this existential, almost nobody else he could turn to. But is your view of their view of Native Americans as bleak as Margaret's, Kathleen?
Well, I think what's interesting is this kind of living in this kind of cognitive dissonance, right, where you do believe that these are pagan, these are heathen. He calls them, you know, the forests are full of wild beasts and wild men, a parallel there. But there's a cognitive dissonance because you know that they know what to do here and you don't. They know what to grow here and you don't. They know where the paths through the woods lead, how to catch the deer, how to catch the fish, and you don't. And so you have to understand and appreciate that there was a deep reliance upon natives at the same time as there was this feeling that they were, you know, less than human. And so to live inside that cognitive dissonance, I think, is part of the chaos of becoming colonial. And so, you know, there's one way in which you kind of look at history and say, what happened, what happened, what happened? Line up the events, line up the evidence. There's another way where you say, how did they make meaning of this? How did they explain this to themselves? And I think that gets at the contradictions that people lived with, and out of which violence and both violence and denial could come.
I want to go straight to a descendant of the Wampanoag tribe that made their survival possible. Linda Coombs joins us from Aquinnah, Massachusetts, author, historian, member of the Wampanoag tribe, program director at the Aquinnah Cultural Center. She's featured in The Pilgrims. Linda Coombs, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you share with our listeners why the Wampanoag eventually cooperated with these very foreign settlers on their shores?
Well, there will be due to the plague, and the Wampanoags had lost, you know, 50% to 90% of our entire population in that plague, and we were at a disadvantage with the Narragansett Indians, and also we noticed that when the English did settle in Patuxet, they had women and children. And it didn't seem like they had come for war, so people watched them for a while. And then, you know, 6 months later, long story short here, they did form an alliance with them.
Against the other tribes surrounding Narragansett to the south, Massachusetts to the north?
Yes.
And that alliance, Rick Burns, critical to their survival.
Oh, they wouldn't. We wouldn't be sitting here. They did, and as Kathleen has pointed out, and as Linda knows so well and conveys so eloquently, they knew they provided the material, crucial material knowledge and support for the Pilgrims to survive. They knew that you buried that when you how to grow corn. How to do it, how to put a herring heads into the yard-wide mounds, when to put the beans and the squash in. So that first, you know, the first Thanksgiving is a direct outcome of the alliance fashioned the previous March, of the fact that Tisquantum, the sole survivor of Patuxet, was there now. He spoke English from his time in Europe. He could actually act as an intermediary.
Unbelievable
that this guy can come in and speak fluent English to help. So, I mean, the most cosmopolitan person there is Tisquantum. He's the, he is an intercontinental citizen who also happens to know how you grow corn. And so, you know, that there's just in every way they would have had to retreat or they would have died out without the accidental alliance that took place because they had come and been depleted on the place that the Wampanoags already were and were so depleted.
Speaking of accidents, Kathleen, the mention of Thanksgiving or that what we now call Thanksgiving is so slight here. William Bradford doesn't even write of it. It barely shows up at all. It's sort of one short paragraph that's turned into our national holiday. What is the historical record and the path that led it has led it to such prominence culturally?
Well, there were only two mentions of in the historical record of what we celebrate now as Thanksgiving. One was in a book called Mort's Relation that Edward Winslow, another pilgrim colonist, had the main hand in authoring, although Bradford also helped in that, and then the other in Bradford's History. Both are very short. At the time, Puritans often had days of Thanksgiving and days of repentance, a very strong belief that God's hand was active in the smallest details and largest designs of everyday life, and that you had to be in constant communication with that either through repentance and a day when everyone in the community did penance to bring you closer to God, and days of Thanksgiving where you realized your utter dependence upon God. So the idea of Thanksgiving is a Puritan idea, certainly. But it wasn't until the mid-19th century that it became a national holiday. And this was brought about by Sarah Josepha Hale, who was an activist and reformer. And in the after, in the midst of the Civil War, realizing that people needed to gather, that there was great suffering, that there were orphans, that there were widows, and that there needed to be some kind of communitarian ideal reestablished around people's tables to give thanks for what they did have. And so it was, again, in the 19th century, picking up these very powerful but really different ideas from the 17th century and making them applicable and meaningful to their current historical moment. And Thanksgiving then gets elaborated from there.
Linda Coombs, it is true that some 90, I guess, Native Americans dropped by, brought some deer, shared a meal. That's been blown up into something quite huge in U.S. culture. When you look back on it as a tribal historian, was the help that the Native Americans gave the Pilgrims a mistake? I mean, war would come, and you know, Native Americans right across the continent displaced, that would all come. Was it a historic mistake for the Natives?
Well, it certainly wasn't helpful to any Native group, but it just, you know, it was a very common practice to make the type of alliance that we did. We had the expectation that the English would honor it, as other Native groups had honored similar alliances, you know, throughout time, and they did not. And unfortunately, we learned that, you know, kind of after the fact.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the week before Thanksgiving, we're talking about the true, deep story of the Pilgrims, harrowing, maybe darker than you knew, and inspiring. A new PBS documentary, The Pilgrims, airs next week. Rick Burns has made it. He's with me in the studio today. Kathleen Donegan is here from the University of California, Berkeley, author of Seasons of Misery, right at the heart of this documentary, along with Linda Coombs, author, historian, member of the Wampanoag tribe, key to the documentary as well, bringing Native American history and perspective on what? Some kind of incredible hinge moment in North American, maybe world history. You can join us. Is there something of this story, the Pilgrim story, still driving us in the world today? Does part of us still aspire to be purer than the world? Henry's calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Henry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Being from Salem, Massachusetts, my understanding is that the Pilgrims were religious fundamentalists. And like many religious fundamentalists, past and present, were not especially liked over in England because it was their way or the highway. And the so-called persecution of them was actually a lot of it in both England and Holland. People just not wanting to be hassled by these people that thought that they were right and their religion way was right and everything, and nothing more really, well, maybe more, but in large part that.
I mean, they were, as Rick Burns says, they were radical fundamentalists. There's no question about it. And such people are often not popular with the status quo, that's for sure.
You know, the Pilgrims in England are remembered to this day as the people who ruined Christmas.
Because?
they all the kind of the rituals of Catholicism were extracted from it. But, true, to be sure, they were radicals and they were fundamentalists, absolutely, as radical Protestants, about as radical as you could be. But they were more sinned against than sinning in their own country. They were not interested in going out to proselytize aggressively. They may have been boring or uninteresting to anybody who found themselves in their midst, but that was about as hard as it was going to be. And you could leave. You didn't have to hang around with them. They were sinned against in the sense that the laws of the land, starting with an act of parliament against the Puritans, against separatism in 1593, made what they did illegal. And what they were doing was meeting separate. They were coming out and being separate and meeting in what were called conventicles in William Brewster's front parlor in Scrooby. And it was that which was considered dangerous and subversive to the realm, and why they could be fined, they could be jailed, they could be banished. If they came back from banishment, that could be itself taken as a sign of sedition, and they could even be killed under those circumstances. Never happened, never visited on our pilgrims. So, as much as some people might have found them, not to their taste, they were not really trying to bring it to anybody else. God would reveal himself to you, and that would be the way. They weren't interested in trying to say – they weren't going to door to door saying, do it our way or it's the highway.
But they would do what it took or what it takes to try and make it successful, to try and survive. And there's this bloody passage where they learn of an impending probably attack by Native Americans there. They go out instead and attack first, strike first in that Native American community. Kill a bunch of Indian leaders there who had apparently plotted to kill the Pilgrims. William Bradford wrote about that. Here's actor Roger Rees reading from that.
By the good providence of God, we killed seven of the chief of them. And the head of one of them stands still upon our fort. For a terror unto others.
Fundamentalist William Standish there among them, soldier, beheaded one of these Native Americans. That head was on a pike, on a pole, at Plymouth for a long, long time. Kathleen Donegan, today we hear about religious fundamentalist radicals looking to establish a new heaven on earth, and people's minds will float to ISIS. Is there something that connects these?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they weren't jihadists, I think that what Rick's saying is important in that the idea was to return to a primitive church, to be separate, to come out from among corruption, to try to establish a pure community. And so they were terrified of contaminants, and they policed their boundaries very aggressively. But they were not proselytizers. I think it's hard to take a term as large as religious fundamentalism or even fanaticism and read it historically across centuries and cultures that are so different. You know, there's a way in which we expand historical categories to try to understand our present day in light of what we know about the past. But if you expand categories too big, they become kind of meaningless, mm-hmm. and you lose the texture, I think, of actual human experience. There's been religious violence all through history. And certainly the Puritans were radical. When they killed Native Americans, they didn't kill them for religious reasons. The problem was that they wanted to create a fundamentally religious culture, but they were involved in very complex and fractious worldly relations with native tribes, with other colonial ventures, with the whole transatlantic world, and also internally, dissensions among themselves. So along with this religious ideal, which we really hold and sanctify, mm-hmm. there was a lot of messy, messy business of daily life and power struggles. And so these particular leaders that you were referring to, they wanted to take out another trading post, a smaller trading post and colony called Wessagusset. But they thought, if we take out Wessagusset, Plymouth is going to retaliate. We have to take out Wessagusset and Plymouth together. And Plymouth got word of it. And so Plymouth made the preemptive attack.
Linda Coombs, as a Wampanoag historian, is there a record, or do you have a sense of how the Native Americans saw, or whether they saw, the extreme religiosity of these settlers? Was it apparent to them? And if it was, do you have any sense of how they understood it? I mean, later, when we got into King Philip's War, which would come just a couple decades later, and you had a terrible conflict with many, many deaths on both sides. I mean, I think I've read reports of Bibles being stuffed into gutted settlers, a kind of indication that Native Americans were aware of it and not entirely enamored of this source of inspiration.
Well, I don't think, religious conversion began to be imposed upon us by the 1630s. And I use the word imposed. It was not something we were choosing to do, because it eventually came down to convert or be killed. We were at a disadvantage because of our lower numbers due to the plague.
Mm-hmm.
The Pilgrims came in, got established, and when the Pilgrims themselves were older and dying, their children, who are now adults, didn't need us. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently, thousands of people are coming in ships, more and more ships from Europe, and just invading our homelands.
Mm-hmm. That wretches the tension up in a hurry. I mean, that's the end of the Native American authority, really, ultimately.
They just overtook us. It's not a simple history. I can't mm-hmm. sit here in 5 minutes or mm-hmm. 2 minutes and mm-hmm. give you a synopsis, because that would not do it justice.
Certainly not, but you do beautifully in this.
Colonial experience is something that continues today.
Mm-hmm.
Started back then. The English came here with the intent to take our land, and they did. And if they had to get rid of us to do it, or use any one of several ways to change us to be like English, like religious conversion, that's what they did. That's why English settlers in King Philip's War ended up with Bibles in their innards or whatever.
Yeah. Windy in Plymouth, Massachusetts, the site of the original settlement. Windy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a point. So my husband and I are both direct descendants of the Pilgrims. So I am a descendant of John Alden, and he's a descendant of Moll Standish. Oh. But I had the opportunity in the late 80s to work for the Wampanoag Indian Program at Plymouth Plantation. Mm-hmm. And so I got a very different perspective, of course, of the whole Plymouth story as I was working there. And in years
different in what way, Wendy? Different in what way, if I may ask?
Well, I grew up in Plymouth, and I grew up learning that it was all Pilgrims, and that Thanksgiving happened as a lovely little get together, and even in history classes, that's the way we learned it at that point. And I remember when I had young children that I was frustrated that they were learning the same information almost. Thanksgiving was all about the Pilgrims. The Thanksgiving parade here is all about the Pilgrims. And so I'm just encouraged that a story that is finally bringing light to the plight of the Wampanoags is going to be put out, because I think, you know, we're so many hundreds of years past this that it's, you know, now maybe our history books will catch up to what actually happened, mm-hmm. you know, during those times, because it certainly wasn't a jolly get-together. It was, you know, it was a dark time.
Kathleen, thank you, Wendy. Kathleen, what do we learn that is important, inspiring, and not in a gauzy way, but that's enlightening by knowing the fullness of the story? That's important to us now for self-understanding, for understanding of the issues Linda's pointing out.
Yeah. You know, it's a big question, and I, you know, just kind of going back to something Rick said about my belief in kind of going slowly through these complex, chaotic moments in history. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I get out of it is challenging myself to sit with the simultaneous presence of suffering and violence, that history is that you don't have to kind of, you know, polarize and make things black and white and bifurcate winners and losers, and either someone was glorious or someone was dastardly. But to sit with the reality that suffering and violence happen together and often happen because of one another. And to understand the complexity of that experience, mm-hmm. while not denying the catastrophic effects of such intense periods of human history, I think that's enlightening, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's kind of a rescue mission to find some bright light of meaning. Mm-hmm. I also don't think it's a kind of assassination mission to mm-hmm. say, you know, mm-hmm. we all gotta put away the turkeys now and, you mm-hmm. know, just stop this nonsense. I think it's a deeper process than that. And if we as a country are ready to reckon with the complexity of that history and its catastrophic effects, I think that can count as a kind of enlightenment.
Times here where everything, Rick Burns, seems so desperate in the actual history of this origin story, just utterly existentially desperate, bones and bodies and suffering. And yes, then violence would come, but on the part of the Native Americans, destroyed by plague, the Pilgrims barely hanging on. The desperation of it all.
I mean, and we don't remember that, of course, this is all taking place in a world context in which Europe was burning down. It was the 30 Years' War which had, in mm-hmm. large mm-hmm. measure, driven the separatist Pilgrim group out of Holland and out of the firing line. I mean, a three-decade-long war between Protestant and Catholic Christianity was burning Europe down. It was really – no, you know, people rarely say – wow, we're living in a transitional moment of history. But there's no question that this key set, these opening decades of the 17th century were a time when so many forces were transforming, were projecting peoples out and around across the world. Globalization, in a sense, was beginning at that time. And what is the Anglo-American presence on the shores of North Atlantic but the beginning of permanent nodes of culture and commerce in the, quote, new world, new, of course, to them and not to Native American groups. So there are so many things that were going on, and at the core of it, the gut core of it, is an experience that is so existentially extreme so dark. There's so much death. And, you know, we tend to think that people who are either very religious or lived a long time ago brushed off death, disease, illness, catastrophic experience with a little bit more elan than we have now. Mm-hmm. Not a bit of it. You know, when your family's wiped out to a person and you're on the shores of Massachusetts in 1621 and saying, what now? You are a person who is out on a serious limb.
They wanted to achieve the ultimate spiritual community on Earth, and that never happened, your documentary tells us. But they did survive. After them would come many more settlers looking at how they had made it. Within a couple of decades, you had 70,000 colonialists in 110 villages along this shore, the New Jerusalem not established, and of course, Bradford would lament that. But he wrote this in his famous book, and I just want to listen, Roger Rees again, as William Bradford from the actual book, speaking of the experience of Plymouth and the Pilgrims.
But them a place did God provide in wilderness, and did them guide unto the American shore, where they made way for many more. They broke the ice themselves alone, and so became a stepping stone for all others who, in like case, were glad to find a resting place.
From Rick Burns, The Pilgrims. It airs next week on PBS on November 24th and again on Thanksgiving Day. Watch it. Take your time with it. As Rick and Kathleen and Linda say, you will profit by it. Linda Coombs, Wampanoag historian, thank you so much for being with us today. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Kathleen Donegan at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you, Professor Donegan.
Thank you, Tom.
And Rick Burns, thanks for this wonderful new documentary.
Thank you, Tom, for this discussion, and to Kathleen and Linda.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.